This podcast is supported by Siemens, your partner for industrial-grade AI.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of our Industrial AI podcast. My name is Robert Weber, and it's a pleasure to talk to
Peter Sieberg. Good morning, Robert. You're on holiday, I hear.
I'm on holiday.
You're not on holiday, but we have holidays again.
We have holidays again, and I'm a bit sick.
Oh.
So let's start with the update before I get too sick in this podcast.
That's the advantage of being connected digitally rather than sitting opposite of each other.
Exactly. I have maybe two pieces of news and one update. May I start with the news?
Please do.
The first news, do you remember Stefan Mills and his safety approach?
Most certainly, yeah.
Yes. He and his team have been acquired by Quantum Systems.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and Quantum was apparently always a customer of Spleenlab, and now they belong together. But the good news is, for sure it's a good news, and Spleenlab is becoming a center of excellence in the field of AI. So huge congratulations to you, Stefan, and your team. Great solutions. I remember when you were at AI in the Alps, everybody was really impressed, and I'm really looking forward what's coming next from Spleenlab or now from Quantum Systems.
Yeah, what I recall, and also congratulations from my side, what I recall is what they had been showing. There was this video, and am I correct, was it about GPS independent recognition is not the right word. I mean, basically for the piece of equipment, I think we're talking
navigation.
Yeah, knowing where the thing is, right? So
without a GPS signal, right?
Yeah, right. So looking at scenery and recognizing scenery and saying, okay, this must be whatever city, whatever piece, whatever thing I'm looking at, which was rather impressive, yeah.
Yeah, and this is very crucial, of course, when it comes to warfare, right? Because of GPS signals and...
Yeah, there we go again. But that's as it is, yeah. And I guess in the end, it's going to be the same. I'm going to move into industrial, but it's the same, more so for process. I mean, for the very same reason you can very well imagine. We typically talk, 90% about discrete manufacturing, cars, bottles, chairs, whatever. But of course, there is the process industry as well, which we shouldn't forget. And if we talk process, there's huge areas of distillers of whatever. There's always something happening you see from very far away. I recall that we were driving to Barcelona in the middle of the night, and you recognize very far away there's some kind of refineries, right? So in these refineries, above these refineries, that's where today already they're using the drones just to be...
And the train inspection, right? So I think Stefan told you that they're using drones over the ICE, over the train, to check the what's coming in the next 300 kilometers or 220 kilometers or what else, yeah.
Yeah, so not only warfare, but also normal day-to-day activities. I'm going to ask you a very similar question. Do you recall that you did a podcast with Shafiq Abu Akar?
Yes, from Saudi AI.
Yeah, right. He's the tech lead, right, for Saudi BMW. And Saudi, I just looked at it. It stands for Synthetic Object Recognition Data Set for Industries, right? There you go. At the very end, I'm going to have a different acronym, which I know by heart, but that's for the end. That's about 2 years ago you did that, and they have a new data set for the industrial AI sector, right? It's coming. So they're about to release it. It's a 1 terabyte. These days, you don't know what the values mean. It's just a couple of years ago. It's not only in our industry. I mean, in our industry, when we talk that, the value of NVIDIA is what? It's also like a T, I believe. Is it like a trillion? Did they pass the trillion? I think it must be the same T for the trillion or the TB. I don't know. So I think it's a terabyte, a synthetic point. cloud data on Kaggle. That was relatively new for me. I hadn't heard about Kaggle for.
No, that's very common, yeah.
It is still common. What is common? I hadn't heard Kaggle a long time. I think I used Kaggle not exactly 10, but towards 10 years ago, you know, looking into the competitions at that time, because I was learning a lot there. So this should be helping to advance machine learning models, robotics, automation.
It's a vision data, or what is it?
Yeah, also for 3D computer vision, exactly. It's synthetic, right? And if that's your topic, dear listener, or for you, Robert, in the other environment you're working in, make sure you get involved there.
Yeah, but be careful. Sometimes you're not allowed to train your model with these data, so you really need to read the licensing topic, because sometimes there are some data sets you can evaluate or you can use for training, but you should not train a model and sell the model then. So be a bit careful.
Very good. Thanks for that recommendation. Yeah, I didn't get into the details there because I'm not training models.
Okay. So the second piece of news from my side comes also from a former guest, our French friend Victor Schmidt from Entalpic. You remember he was in our, I think, 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. And they now introduce a generative AI framework. It's now, listen, that designs catalyst materials from first principles, combining machine learning predictors with generative flow networks, they call it like this, to efficiently explore chemical spaces and identify promising materials for hydrogen energy storage. Do you remember Max Welling is also working in this field? And he said, Cas, I'm working on a Google search engine for molecules, yes? And this is very interesting that you have now a generative AI framework that designs catalyst materials. That's impressive, I think. I will include a link to the paper in the show notes, but this is very, very, very impressive.
I saw another company doing, I think they called it Fold. Is it related to the Google? What is it? The Google, was it Alpha? That was Alpha Fold. I thought this was a different one. So it seems like a huge industry of loads of big tech and also startups working in this area. And if it is along those lines, what I recall, it was about, it started, I think, that was the AlphaFold with the proteins, right? So you put 10 researchers together, you have an hypothesis, you work for 10 years, and at the end of the 10 years, you say, oh, shit, that was nothing. Isn't that how research, a lot of research, not all research, worked until, you know, or still works these days? And you start again with a new hypothesis, and you do the same thing. And then you turn it the other way around, and then you start using Gen AI and say, okay, give me your space. Now, I believe in this space you're looking at a solution. Give me your, almost like along the lines of reinforcement learning, tell me what it is that you're looking for, what it is that you want to get out of your protein or material, whatever we're looking at, right? And then I think you should be looking at X, Y, Z, something like that. That is really amazing, right?
Mm-hmm. But to be crystal clear for all listeners, maybe who are not so familiar with these kind of AI, this is not LLM-based Gen AI topic. So it's generative AI framework, but it has nothing to do with ChatGPT, Llama, Gemini, or etc. It's a generative flow network. So this is very important, because sometimes we mix things, then they say, oh, Gen AI, this, now Gen AI can find molecules or new catalyst materials. No, this is not Gemini, Llama, ChatGPT, Anthropic, right?
Well, at least it is not generating the language. Maybe it is somewhere on the way. But I would consider it to be part of this big thing called generative AI. It does generate new things. Isn't that the difference?
So sure.
We look at the time series,
exactly.
We talked about a couple of times, so, and then the algorithms looks in the data. And that is what we've been doing for 10 years, typically the machine learning. So the algorithm is capable of finding relations which we humans don't see. We look at a screen on an Excel, and if there's, you know, five rows and six lines, we look at them for 5 minutes. And, you know, that's like an intelligence question. And then people see, oh, there's a certain relation, something is happening. That's what we can do. That's all we can do, right? And then if we take it a trillion times, then the algorithms can find. And then, you know, when the generative AI with the large language models came, I mean, and that's my assumption, is we're not using it with the language, but with a different approach, generating new things. That's in the end what it's doing, right? And I guess I'll come to that later, if that's going to be taken over by AI as well. But as long as we're here, you are here as researchers, dear listeners, you are taking care of this and you're using the tools. And you then say, thank you very much for this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 suggestions. And we, as a team of researchers, take one and we say, okay, this is the perfect one. And then you maybe got it after 3 months instead of 3 years.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. What else do you have, Peter?
Trumpf.
Okay.
Trumpf, as we say. Yeah, it is always, when I see the word, I'm never sure how to pronounce it. There is the company in Germany, that's the one we talk about, and they received the ASML Supplier Award. Now, that's normally not a typical thing, maybe I will talk about, but there you go. It's for their new EUV, extreme ultraviolet high energy laser, to be used in ASML's next generation EUV lithography systems. Now, most of you will have heard the last couple of weeks, there's so many things, and that's where the other name, term, comes into the picture, political decisions between United States, China. When I say little country, I mean it little, as far as the size
is concerned.
In the
middle of the storm, yeah.
Of the Netherlands in the middle of this storm. And that is what this in the end is all about, with on the basis of this Dutch company ASML, the world of the top level extreme ultraviolet, you know, moving towards whatever 4, 3, 2, 1 nanometers. Now, a personal congratulations to Rainer Thieringer.
Rainer, congrats.
Rainer is the global technology scout at Trumpf. He joined us a couple of weeks ago at AI in the Forest number 2. And we talked about, of course, we talked about laser. And I bragged about knowing the meaning of laser acronym by heart. And if you want to, I can. But it's useless, because you will think that I'm reading it out. Anyway, it stands for light amplification by stereoisotropic emission of radiation. So it's a very, 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 very strong signal. And by the way, again, talking warfare, I saw there, because we're having problems with the drones, and I saw that there's now a laser solution there as well.
Exactly.
So again, congratulations, Rainer Thieringer. We are very much looking forward to see many additional solutions based on laser technology.
Okay, perfect. Do you have something else? Because you mentioned the Netherlands. I was in Amsterdam last week.
Oh, tell me.
And I met Stratis again, our friend Stratis Gaffers. He's a professor at the University of Amsterdam. And he gave us some insights into his world robotics models. And I'm not allowed to tell more what he's doing, but something big is coming out of Amsterdam.
No, really?
So yeah, I was very impressed what they are doing there.
Are we going to see it when we're there in January?
Exactly, because I also checked our hotel, and I checked all the connections, and we checked the dinner and etc. And we are heading to Amsterdam on the 21st of January, and we still have 3 spots available. So fill out the form quickly and join us. And for those who have already registered, we will inform you, I think, in 2 weeks about the hotel, flights, etc. So I'm really looking forward to visit Stratis. And I met Cass Snook also. Cass was also there.
I think you see Cass as well. Okay.
Yeah, Cass. And Cass will also join on 21st of January with his group. So we have 2 groups of PhDs from Cass and from Stratis. I think they are really looking forward to pitch their ideas in front of the industrial AI community. So they were very impressed. And it's so funny because Stratis always talks not about AI in the Alps. His frame is AI retreat, your AI retreat you are doing in summer. So maybe you need to rename it to the AI retreat. Yeah.
Oh, right. Are we going to be doing a canal boat thing as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, exactly. He will organize that for the first evening. Yes.
I recall.
Yeah, we went to the Qualcomm lab and yeah, it was very interesting.
As a Dutch guy, as a young Dutch guy, that was the thing I hated. I hated most of Amsterdam. And I recall there was this picture of my family, my parents, brother, sister, kids, and we were standing. I think we just came off the boat.
Peter, please smile. Peter, can you please smile?
When I was a young guy, I was already always smiling. So you don't see that. Maybe it wasn't perfect. But now I'm really, really looking forward to it. I do have a before final piece related, because one silicon company that we may expect their foundry, TSMC, to be using the ASML technology in the near future is Qualcomm.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And Qualcomm, they announced what they call Edge AI on steroids. It's called Dragon Wing AI on-prem appliance. AI moving closer. Well, what should I say? You've been telling me in the past that's one of Peter's belly things, right? Edge AI. And there you go. When was I saying it? 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think so. 2020, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we have been many times maybe just ahead of our times. So that's going to bring intelligence to enterprise, retail, everything, and of course to manufacturing. Now, there are loads of specs. I'm not going to call them out. One is their model families. So they're going to have Llama, GPT, Qwen, Gemma, thousands, they say, from Hugging Face. And I was thinking, XLSTM, question mark, maybe.
Yeah, but this is not a model, right? So this is not a model. This is an architecture. We will see some model in the future, I will think.
Okay, very good. And then I thought, because where are we going to be exactly in Amsterdam? That was the relationship here. Are we going to be university? Are we actually going to be at Qualcomm?
Yeah, there's a connection between the university and the Qualcomm lab.
All right.
And I think in the moment, Stratis is the director of the Qualcomm lab in Amsterdam, but I'm not sure, is it KS or is it Stratis? One of them is the director of the Qualcomm lab there. Yeah.
So if the guys are listening, maybe we can experience the Edge AI on steroids rather than...
Right, exactly.
experiencing other steroids in Amsterdam.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. What else do you have, Peter?
I do have a final one. So, according to Sam, you know, the Sam, if you are an AI researcher listening in, you have only about 2 years left to invent AI with your brain, to do it yourself, you and your team, right? Because, according to Sam, I mean, OpenAI is going to have an automated AI research intern by September 2026. That's a year, not completely a year from now. That's the intern. And then just 1.5 years later, March 28, they say they're going to have an automated AI researcher. Yeah. And if that's going to happen, you know, then what's going to happen if that's going to happen? So they say they're going to be handling, it's one of these updates that he was doing with his, I think, Jakub, another Jakob. Jakob is the CTO or, you know, the number one researcher at OpenAI. Jakub, like the Jakob we know from Poland. I was just looking at it. I wasn't sure. And they're going to handle tasks starting with maybe today from 5 seconds, tasks to 5 minutes, to days, 5 weeks, 5 months, to 5 years. I think the idea being something that, you know, a human being today would, you know, take 5 months or 5 years, we just talked about, that this automated AI researcher will be handling. So, and when you listen, I mean, I saw pieces of it yesterday. I didn't see the complete thing. You're never sure, but and Sam, he doesn't like this thing. When are we going to have AGI? And he doesn't like it. He moves it away. He says, forget it, because the term is way, way overloaded. But we keep on coming back to, there was this time, what was it called? the single moment when, you know, algorithms were going to be taking over. And it was a time was called 2020-45, I believe, yeah, singularity. And do you recall the guy? He was from Australia. He wrote a book. What was his name?
It's Thomas, you know, it was...
And he had a different, I think he said it was more like 2016.
He was a guest in our podcast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was.
Toby.
I recall I was somewhere on a campsite when I was talking to you. For whatever reason, my brain gives me that picture.
Toby Walsh.
There you go. Also a professor from, I think, Australia.
Professor at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, right?
And also in Berlin, I believe, yeah. So at that time, at that time, everybody was giving their time when it was going to happen. And we were kind of, oh, yeah. I mean, in the book, I say, as soon as there was a year given for singularity, 2045, I think I said that's kind of maybe a little bit funny, so to say. I don't know. And now, these days, although we don't call it singularity, but we still mean exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I remember.
But there is this thing. On one hand, there is this thing, it's so close. And then there's the other, I mean, I'm not sure if the teams, if the people are, I don't know where you feel yourself, if we're 50-50, whatever, but there's this huge group of people who say this is happening. Other people say, well, you know, the base technology is still prediction of words, basically, right? So, I mean.
Exactly. Yeah, let's move to the main part. And I talked to Gabriel Krummenacher. You remember?
Oh, we had him before, yeah.
Gabriel, yeah, he was also part of our AI in the Alps group. And there's a connection to what you mentioned, because he said, that was interesting, no Gen AI project without a proper data science team. So you can run Gen AI projects, that's okay, but if your data science team is not good and you have no data science team, this project will fail, or the outcome of this project won't be good. So you still need data scientists also for Gen AI projects. So this was very interesting, and he will explain why.
Okay. So there's still room, life, jobs, work for data scientists. That's
exactly.
Another huge topic, right? And it comes back to what I just said. Yeah. One half says, you know, people have studied data science, they don't find a job. And I'm very much looking forward to Gabriel saying the opposite. You know, I'm not sure if he's still hiring. So that's why I'll look into it. So then there's the other group of people say, no, I mean, no AI without data scientists. And I think that's going to be the overall theme 2-3 weeks from now in Berlin at the Machine Learning Week as well, where typically data scientists gather.
Perfect. Peter, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Robert, enjoy your holidays, or you are working in the environment of the holidays, and talk to you soon again. Thanks. Bye-bye.
My guest today is Gabriel Krummenacher from Zülke. Welcome, Gabriel.
Hi, Robert.
You were our guest during the first Gen AI hype phase. Today I checked, it was still in German, and it was with publishing the first ChatGPT model, I think. Welcome back to our podcast. And today we want to talk about a survey, a study that you did together with a lot of industrial companies. But before we do this, please introduce yourself briefly to the listeners.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm very happy to be back. I also checked and remember this. It's quite some time ago now. Yeah, so I'm Gabriel. I'm Director of Data Science and Partner at Zülke. My background is in machine learning and computer science. We do machine learning and AI projects for clients.
And you are now mainly focused on agentic Gen AI hype train, or is there any other topic at Zülke in the moment?
No, so we're still doing
traditional
regular machine learning. Traditional machine, all machine learning as well. But of course, we're also doing a lot of Gen AI LLM projects.
Okay. You did a study with a lot of industrial companies. Can you explain a little bit the background of the survey, of the study, who was involved, and how did you work?
Sure. So, I mean, this was a collaboration between us and Institute at ETH in Zurich. So we worked together with Professor Stefano Brusoni for technology and innovation management. And so we kind of combined their interest and our interest and expertise. For us, it was mainly on AI. And from them, it was exactly on this kind of like what companies are successful over longer time horizons and why. And so this is their study topics. And we were interested mainly in, because I mean, so we started this collaboration quite some time ago, and then it was relatively complicated to set everything up and also to get enough respondents and so on. And so we started with, there's a lot of hype and there's a lot of people talking about AI and also a lot of companies doing AI. I mean, we're also working on this together with clients, so we can see this, but we were interested in outside of our clients, like in the DACH region, but also in other countries, and how far are companies already? And we wanted to know, and there wasn't really any like large service on not just what's your strategic plan or how do you do governance and things like this, but really on what applications do you have in your company with AI that already have impact? So they're already saving you money. They're already increasing your revenue. They're already crucial for customer satisfaction, or they're already enabling new products and services. And so we summarized this as impactful machine learning application. And then we wanted to know what companies already have impactful machine learning applications, and then what do these applications look like? What types of applications, what type of use cases, in what organizational context? So this is kind of like what department of the company, and many, many different questions. So it was quite an extensive and in-depth survey.
What are these use cases? Can you share the most important findings?
Yes, we coded them into different categories. And so the most important use case is operational efficiency.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
So this is kind of everything related to, it's kind of like optimization. So there's things like process optimization, but also resource planning is under this umbrella term.
So it's also about demand forecasting and stuff like this?
So demand forecasting is, we had another category for this especially. So demand forecasting is not inside operational efficiency, but that's also in the top three. So that's also a top three use case that we saw.
What is a common use case for operational excellence or operational benefits when it comes to AI?
So what we saw is a lot of resource planning is under this umbrella. So assigning staff, for instance, as well. So there was company describing applications where they would do who's available when, and then they had an AI tool that helped them schedule. But it was also for non-human sources. This was new to me. So I've never worked too much with this use case. So this was quite interesting to see that this has such an impact in this already, kind of like broadly used.
Because from my point of view, it's also surprising because since 10 years, we hear the predictive maintenance use case, right? So I thought this would be number one. And when it comes to classification and prediction of the maintenance process, what about these classical machine learning approaches?
So we also see them. And I mean, these top three are across all types of industries. So this is not just manufacturing. And so I think this also, because predictive maintenance in a finance company is not going to be a use case. I think that's one of the reasons. But predictive maintenance is in there. That's also a popular use case.
Can you share some more findings of your survey?
Sure. So I think what I found very interesting was not just what types of applications people do, but also how they do them. Because the idea was maybe other companies can learn from how the most impactful use case for these companies looks like. So we asked them, for your most impactful use case, how did you build it? Like, how did you train a model yourself? Did you buy a product? Is this on an in-house data platform, in the cloud, on-premise, and all kinds of questions? And kind of like what we saw consistently across respondents for their most impactful use case was that they were using internal data. And so, I mean, I guess to people working in this field, this is not so surprising, but it was really like leveraging their know-how about processes, about the data, about their core business to build these types of applications. So a lot of companies were using internal data. They're also labeled internally. So 70% of the companies didn't outsource the labeling, but they actually used in-house expertise to label the data. And more than half of the companies actually trained the models themselves.
Wow, that's a lot, right?
Yeah, it's a lot. And then even if they used external models, they did fine-tune. So a lot of the external models were then still fine-tuned on their specific use case. And I think what this shows is that it's really, to have impact with these use cases, it's important to leverage somehow the information that your competitors or other companies don't have, and like use your internal know-how and data to actually be successful.
But I'm surprised, because training by their own is very Yeah, it's intense to have workforce to do that at the end, because AI scientists, researchers, machine learning experts, machine learning engineers, you have to hire them. It's very difficult to hire them. So what surprised you there?
Yes, no, I agree. And I mean, it's not just with internal staff. So it's just that for the application, it was trained or fine-tuned. So this can also mean it was done by a partner, or it was maybe customized from a product. So it's not necessarily like data scientists of that company. It's more the important aspect is that it's trained and adapted to the specific use case, and not so much how and who did this customization.
And can you share some more use cases or categories where the companies see the most benefit when it comes to AI?
So another one that I also find interesting was that automated data processing, because it's such a broad use case. And initially, it wasn't really clear to me like what that means. And so it's really a lot of like using AI to process data in internal processes. So it's kind of like automated transformation of data, automated extraction of data. And I think this is also a lot of the Gen AI use cases. I mean, some of them are in marketing and sales, where you actually generate material. But then a lot of them is also in this like structured data extraction field. So this is already the top two use case in that survey.
Mm-hmm. And how do you define benefit in the end? So what means benefit?
So that's a very good question. So we also asked them, what KPIs do you measure? And then we looked at this in different industries and different fields. And it's kind of interesting to look at the split. So we categorize them into business KPIs and technical KPIs. And technical KPIs would be things that, I mean, your data scientist optimized for. And then business KPI is what you're actually interested in, why you build these kind of applications. And then depending on the field, so in R&D and more industrial use cases, they were more focused on technical KPIs, I think, by the nature of the people who drive these initiatives. And then in like the more go-to market focused use cases, it was much more business KPIs, but it was always both of them. So it was not like companies somehow really looked at both. And I think you have to, you need to measure your business impact, but then you need to translate this into something you can actually optimize for directly, because usually what you're interested in, you might not even be able to measure or not measure already. So maybe this is also something you can see an impact after a couple of months or so.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's very difficult to measure at the beginning, right? In which state they were, these companies? Can you summarize that a bit?
For these initiatives, or you mean in general overall?
Yeah.
So for them, they had already done it. So we only asked for use cases where they could already say that they have an impact. So we didn't.
Okay.
We wanted to exclude kind of POC state initiatives.
Okay. And you check the whole survey. What surprised you most from you and your team?
So what I found most surprising was the last part of the survey. So we had, as I said, it was mostly about your impactful application and also like where do you use AI in general. And then at the end, we wanted to know about ethical frameworks. So we had a section on like what kind of governance do you have in your company? We asked overall in general, do you have an ethical framework? Do you have like regulatory processes, training, monitoring, risk assessment, you know, everything around actually deploying AI? And then one possible expectation is that you say the more freedom a company or the data scientists have, the more AI they do. But it was the opposite. So essentially what we saw is that the companies that have more standards, more ethical frameworks were more successful. So they used AI throughout a larger part of the company, and they had more impactful AI application.
Why is it?
This is a good question. So our hypothesis is that it's because it actually allows, it takes away uncertainty. So if you have a project team or someone that wants to do something and you have no clear guidelines and rules, you either don't know how to start. Maybe you don't do something, or you ask, but then no one really knows. And then you don't want to take the risk yourself. But if you have clear guidelines, you kind of give the environment, right? And so it's much easier. You can read up, you are trained, you know what the company wants to do, and also how to deal with some of the complexities of using AI, like how do we deal with bias, what types of application, if I want to do an application in, say, HR, how do I deal with this, like who can I talk to, and so on. So I think this is what really helps the company.
But this is in total contrast to what we heard every every week that governance won't give you the creativity to build new models, to develop new ideas.
Yes, but I think it's also a different type of regulation, because what we also saw is that in the US, companies actually had more of these regulations internally, and this is probably because they have to, because there's no AI Act in the US. I mean, now in California, but this survey was done before. And so companies, I guess, were more forced to do it. That's maybe one explanation. I mean, it could also be that just in general, the culture is differently in US companies. And so in Europe, companies had this less. And maybe because they know there's already a law, so they don't have to have the regulations themselves. But so it's not like the companies in the EU were further. So in the US, they still do more AI. So the ranking was essentially US, UK, and then the DACH region. And at the same time, the US had more ethical frameworks within the company.
Okay, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So let's talk about the elephant in the room, Gen AI use cases. What about Gen AI use cases?
So what we saw, I think, and what was the most interesting aspect of this, and also for our partner ETH, is that companies that had done already machine learning and AI before, they were more successful with generative AI. Because for them, it was an interesting question because this is something they got asked, is should we try to be a follower or not? Like, should we just wait and then the technology gets mature and then we don't have to invest, and so we can just wait and then like wait for the technology to progress. And it seems like, at least from the data in that survey, for generative AI, this is not the case. So companies that already had, I mean, it kind of obvious, like if you have data scientists, if you have the processes, also the experience and know-how, it's easier then to also do generative AI use cases.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, but this is what I thought, right? So this is not surprising, or what is your opinion?
No, I agree. It's not surprising, but it was nice to see kind of like also in the data, because still, I mean, as I said, we're also doing a lot of Gen AI projects, and some people started treating them not as a data science project. Because I guess also companies that don't have the experience, or teams that don't have this experience. And in our experience, this is usually hinders success, because a Gen AI project, from the nature of how you do the project, is still a data science project, even though the data scientists don't train the models. All the rest of the process is a data science project, like evaluation, kind of like expectation management of, you need to do a proof of concept before you know what the results will be. You can't just treat it as like an agile software development project. And I think this is also what the survey shows, is that the companies that know how to do data science projects also know how to do generative AI projects.
Do you have some finding when it comes to Gen AI and benefits, or is it too early to call?
Yes. So, I mean, in this survey, there was also, it's kind of a mix of all of these different types of applications. What we saw was mainly in terms of where Gen AI is used. And so it was a lot in marketing and HR, where classical machine learning is not as prominent, which also I think is not surprising. And this is also something we saw, is that the US here is much further. So one reading of the survey is that the US is quicker in adapting kind of like products and quick wins, and just using Gen AI immediately in like HR and marketing and all the go-to-market sales customization. Whereas European companies or the DACH region, say this is what we had in the survey, is more focusing on like R&D use cases in like the core business, but not as much in kind of like the services part of the organization in other departments. And I think their Gen AI has a lot of potential. And here the US seems to be further. Whereas in like what we looked at before, these applications where you kind of build on your own data a use case, this is not the part where the DACH region is behind.
Is it because of a lack of data in the field of sales and marketing, maybe in Germany, because, or in the DACH region? Because when you look at US companies, what they can collect data when it comes to advertising, marketing, communication, sales, they really have more freedom to do that.
I mean, I guess this could be one explanation, that they're also more willing to use this data, or they have more freedom to do this. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
or the availability of the data. Yeah. When you now go back to your customer, what did you learn from the results? What does it now mean in your daily work with your customers?
So I think what was nice was to see that it's worth building these custom applications for impact. I mean, this is something we took away. The other thing was kind of like in the types of use cases, because what's also showed is essentially, and I mean, this is not kind of like novel, but it was also just nice to see it as a result of the survey, is that focus on applications where you have clearly defined KPIs that you can actually measure and start with these. So the companies with the impactful applications, they were also things that have like a direct impact that you can then measure. So it's things that you, if you optimize this, you really have a benefit, and it's not just driven by like technology somehow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And apart from the survey, what topics resonate with your customers? What are these use cases? Where, what are they doing in the moment?
So, I mean, of course, at the moment, kind of like broadly, agentic AI is, that's what everything wants to talk about.
Okay.
And so this is, of course, a huge topic.
Agentic AI means, so the whole MCP, agents, communication layers, etc.
Yes. And then, of course, it's also, I mean, people mean different things with agentic AI. And so there's a lot of education involved as well. And just like trying to explain to people like where you can use it, what it means and so on. And so, I mean, essentially, yes. I mean, it's kind of like calling tools in a loop with a large language model. We do see quite a few interesting applications there as well. So, I mean, there's this kind of like the hype part, and people just want to do something. And as you said, like stick things together with MCP. But where we saw it be quite useful is in kind of like building your own Copilot features into your product. So we have a client, and they have essentially a large asset management software for factories. And we're together with them, we're building at the moment a feature where the users can use large language models within their own software. And then the tool use is really, really useful, because otherwise you can just access kind of like PDF documents. But now we can access the APIs of their own software. We can access structured data, databases. They have like a graph database that we can access. And so this really helps in like answering questions. So they can now use this to answer questions like a pump fails here. Like, can you analyze? And then the tool can actually go and look at different types of data and logs and look at the graph, like what are neighboring components in that installation and all kind of things. And this is quite useful.
But you need a classification model to do that, right? So as a part of this agentic approach, when you want to say, oh, there's a failure in the pump, you need a classification model to do that.
So for the failure, yes. And I mean, also, if we look at the time, so there's time series data that you can look at. I mean, at the moment, we don't have this. So we don't have a forecast. But in principle, you could also forecast within the time series and then give this forecast to the agentic solution. Absolutely. And I think, well, interestingly, we saw this in the survey as well. So a lot of the successful use cases were a combination of Gen AI and traditional machine learning as well. And I think agentic AI is perfectly suited for this.
Yes, because you mentioned earlier that Gen AI is also a data science project. And when it now comes to let's implement or add a time series model to your LLM, then the agent has to find, or you have to give the agent the right data, right? And then it starts again as a data science project, right?
Yes, absolutely. But even before, because, I mean, one thing that makes this hard is somehow you have all these different agents. And I mean, of course, one important principle is to not make this structure too complex. So you kind of like in 80% of the cases, you want one main agent and then stateless sub-agents, because otherwise it gets impossible to debug. But still, like, you need to have a very good evaluation framework and data. So you need to think hard about how can you generate ground truth data? How can you continuously test this? And how can you make it as transparent and leaky as possible, so you can actually get insights and debug and measure how well this works.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So the LLM is becoming the interface at the end, or am I wrong?
No, I think that's true.
So we will still see, let's call it traditional machine learning models and approaches, but they will get an interface powered by an LLM. Is that the right definition?
I think so. I think this is certainly something we will see in some fields. And I mean, other fields, a chatbot is not the right user interface, and then we don't see it. So I think in a lot of computer vision applications, it's not necessarily the best tool. And I mean, even here, it's A chat is quite hard to understand because it's not very transparent. It's just like an input field. So you don't see the capabilities. And this is also something we see with these agentic use cases, is that for the user, it's impossible to see what this tool can do. So you also need to put a lot of effort into essentially the prompt to explain to the user immediately, like, this is a capability we don't have because you don't know it. Like, it doesn't show you what the tool can do.
I want to come back to what you mentioned when it comes to agentic and time series and classification. I think then you will see a trend that you need models that run as a zero-shot models, right? Because you are not able to train it a long time with the agent. So you need zero-shot capabilities for the models. Or am I wrong there?
I don't think necessarily, because you could still have essentially regular machine learning application. Say you have a time series forecasting model and you could train this as you would do otherwise. And then you can give the deployed model, you can give the LLM access to the deployed model, and then you can still use it. It's, in a way, it's just then that you can give your agent access to also the results of the forecast or the classification, or you could have like a quality use case on, say, like in industry, in production, and you have cameras and you do some kind of anomaly detection or you do quality inspection with computer vision, and then you could give the results of these models to your LLM, something like this. But then the machine learning use case would still be the thing.
Okay. Gabriel, thanks a lot. What is on your agenda for the next coming months?
I'm going to be at the pharma conference in Basel, which is going to be interesting. There's a lot of very interesting use cases in pharma as well. And then I'm working on interesting projects in like risk engineering, one in more computer vision and also transcription. So a lot of interesting ML topics.
Gabriel, thanks a lot. It was a pleasure. Best regards and thanks a lot and greetings to Switzerland.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, Robert. Always a pleasure to be here.